From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Alyssa Block. Today, a number of developments in the NSA surveillance story. First, Edward Snowden says he is still in Hong Kong. He gave an interview to the South China Morning Post and said he plans to fight any attempt to extradite him back to the U.S. for leaking classified documents.
On Capitol Hill, the man who heads the NSA, General Keith Alexander, appeared before a Senate panel. He told lawmakers that surveillance programs have helped to stop dozens of attacks.
And some of the biggest technology companies are asking for permission to divulge how often they turn over data to the government. As NPR's Jim Zaroli reports, companies such as Google and Facebook worry the controversy will harm relations with their customers.
Companies such as Google are very much caught in the middle of the current debate about government security and privacy. Press reports have said they are required to turn over huge amounts of customer data to government agencies like the NSA, but they are often barred from saying anything publicly about the requests they get. So customers are left to wonder whether someone is looking over their shoulders when they go on sites like Facebook. Sarah Rotman Epps is a senior analyst at Forrester Research.
Google, Facebook, Microsoft, and the rest of the companies are at risk of losing customer trust. And I think they're frustrated by their inability to talk directly about these matters with their customers.
And this is an especially big issue in large, growing overseas markets. One of the surveillance programs at issue, known as PRISM, analyzes data collected by U.S. tech companies from foreign users. Manfred Weber is a member of the European Parliament, which has expressed big concern about the programs.
We are interested in what is going on. Is there really a checking of all the emails? Is there really a checking of all the internet traffic? We want to know how it works.
And this could well affect the bottom line at companies like Google. Weber says U.S. surveillance programs appear to give Americans broader privacy protections than non-Americans. He says European regulators are especially bothered by this, and it could well affect Google's ability to do business in these markets. Yesterday, Google sent a letter to Attorney General Eric Holder asking for permission to reveal how often it really turns over customer information to the government. Microsoft, Twitter, and Facebook quickly echoed the request. These companies say releasing this information will dispel the notion that government investigators are given unlimited access to customer data. Ben Wisner of the ACLU applauds Google's move.
We've seen in the last week how important it can be for the public to learn not just about the existence of surveillance, but about the scope of that surveillance.
Wisner says when it comes to government surveillance programs, Google has been a big advocate of transparency. But he also says Google and the other companies could be doing more.
It would be nice to see some of these companies going into court and challenging the gag orders that have prevented them from sharing information about national security surveillance.
But it's also true that these companies have to strike a delicate balance on surveillance issues. They need to show they're willing to cooperate with the government to address legitimate security concerns. They just have to do it without giving their customers the impression that someone's watching them every time they go online. Jim Zaroli, NPR News, New York.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Alyssa Block. 20 years ago this week, this mega movie roared into theaters. Jurassic Park. The 1993 film brought dinosaurs to life in a way that had never been done before.
Yep, that's one scary Tyrannosaurus.
I think I was 13 when that movie came out, so it has played a big part in my childhood and my life.
That's Michael Darr. He writes for LiveScience.com. As a fan, he wrote an article comparing what we know of dinosaurs today with the science featured in that movie two decades ago.
Let's take the movie version of T-Rex.
Well, we clocked the T-Rex at 32 miles an hour.
You said you've got a T-Rex?
Uh-huh. Say again. We have a T-Rex.
In the movie, the T-Rex chased after cars and ate people, but Darr says not so.
So T-Rex in the film is portrayed as this hunter who goes after big prey, but the evidence shows that the T-Rex operated more like a scavenger, so he would have looked for prey that was already dead. He wouldn't have run very fast.
More recent science suggests dinosaurs would also have looked quite different. They were more colorful and...
It's probable that if you were actually to go back in time and look at a T-Rex, it would be, you know, maybe kind of cute. It would have a lot of plumage and feathers.
Q cute? Bright plumage and feathers? What?
So maybe they would have been less of that and more of this.
And now, a poem by Big Bird. That's me.
T-Rex was more like a big bird, according to Michael Darr at Live Science. But could that work in a dinosaur movie?
I guess you can make anything scary. Big Bird with teeth might be a little frightening as well.
I don't know, Audie. Big Bird's definitely not as scary.
Reckless bets on real estate can cause trouble. The 2008 market crash comes to mind. But many financial advisors say some real estate in an investment or retirement portfolio is a good idea. NPR's Uri Berliner has been trying to figure out what to do with $5,000 he has in a savings account that is losing value to inflation. And today, in our series Dollar for Dollar, he discovers that what qualifies as real estate goes far beyond what he imagined.
Here's one way to tell real estate prices are rising.
You may know me as Vanilla Ice. When I'm not touring around the world, I'm here in Palm Beach making money in real estate. I flip houses.
The house flipping shows made a comeback. Buy, remodel, sell, repeat. We've been there before and didn't end happily. And yet, prices fell so hard during the crash, 50% or more in some parts of the country, that a rebound just makes sense. Josh Dorkin runs a real estate investment website called Bigger Pockets. I ask him what kind of real estate bet I can make for, say, $1,000. His advice? Be careful.
You know, we're kind of in a bubble. Once again, we've got these historically low interest rates. We've got the big money funds coming into the market. If you're savvy and know what you're doing, there's always going to be an opportunity.
Dorkin runs me through my options.
You could go and flip a house. Of course, you'd need to go out and take out a high-risk loan, more likely than not to do that. And of course, doing that is really kind of like running a job in itself.
Scratch that.
Other options include crowdsourcing or syndication.
Too complicated.
And I think the final option is really to go out and buy shares of a REIT, real estate investment trust.
REITs are sold like stocks. They're held by many individuals and institutional investors. You might have a REIT in your retirement fund. REITs are trusts that own and develop property and earn rental income. Most of it gets passed on to investors. Brad Thomas is the editor of The Intelligent REIT Investor.
They are forced by law, which is a law created in 1960. That law provides that real estate investment trusts have to meet certain tests, and if they do, they have to pay out 90% of their taxable income in the form of dividends.
Those dividends are a regular stream of income, and they're what make REITs attractive to investors. In a rising real estate market, they're what clinch it for me. I put down $514 on a REIT index fund. It's basically a smorgasbord of many different REITs. It contains what you might expect, REITs that own apartment buildings and shopping centers. But Brad Thomas says the range of REITs today goes far beyond that.
From billboards to prisons to cell towers, campus housing, even solar is on the horizon potentially.
With that in mind, I decide to check out some of my holdings. I'm inside a 5x5-foot self-storage unit in Bethesda, Maryland. When the housing market picks up, people move more often. They need some place to stash their stuff for a while. Couches, microwaves, cribs, you name it. They want more space, and they rent it from companies like Public Storage, a real estate investment trust.
And that's not the only investment in storage I've made.
You'll notice there's a biometric reader on this as well. So for us to get access to this room, I need to use my card and my fingerprint.
That's Dunna Roche of Digital Realty, a REIT that owns and operates 122 data centers around the world. Digital Realty is part of the fund I bought, so I've got a tiny little stake in all those data centers. We're in one of them in Ashburn, Virginia, near Dulles Airport. Data centers are like unfurnished apartments for digital information, secure and climate-controlled, plenty of reliable power, and with more companies using the cloud, demand for these digital apartments is growing.
So what we're looking at in the cloud is rows and rows of large 7-foot tall cabinets stacked with server computers in them. Lots of flashing lights, a lot of information coming in and out of those machines.
When I started out looking to invest in real estate, I never thought I would wind up owning a little piece of the cloud, or a stake in storage units, or a bit of my former workplace. But it turns out that one of the many holdings in the fund I bought is a REIT called Boston Properties. Boston Properties, I discover on their website,
now owns the site where, until recently, NPR had its headquarters. We moved out almost 2 months ago. Now they're tearing the old NPR down, and a new building with law offices will go up in its place. Bulldozers are doing fast work. There's lots of debris around. Larry Smoot is the superintendent on the job, and he comes up to me with a serious piece of real estate right in his hands.
This came off of the Massachusetts side of the face of the building that we're taking down, so it's marble off the face of the building.
Nice guy. He just hands it to me. I didn't even have to tell him I was an investor. Uri Berliner, NPR News.
Support for Dollar for Dollar comes from CFP, Certified Financial Planner Professionals, Retirement, Budgeting, Insurance, helping bring clients' finances together at letsmakeaplan.org.
Jerry Seinfeld visited us a while back to talk about his love of coffee, a love he only developed in recent years, and that passion inspired an experimental talk show where he adds two other things he loves, cars and comedians.
We're dying for some coffee.
Black coffee.
Americano's perfect for me.
I'm buying my coffee.
I'll take some coffee with cream.
I'm sweet and low.
You're not drinking coffee if you're not drinking it black, don't you think?
No, I don't think.
Oh, you like a monkey with it?
The voices of Sarah Silverman, Seth Meyers, God El-Malay, Chris Rock, Don Rickles, and David Letterman, they have all taken rides in a car to get a cup of coffee and chat with Jerry Seinfeld. They are the guests that will be featured in the new season of his web series, Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee. Jerry Seinfeld, welcome back to our program.
Thank you, Linda. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, I gather that the premise of this web show of yours is that you put together three things Jerry Seinfeld loves: cars, coffee, and comedy.
Yes. What? But it's also the subtraction of a lot of things I hate is another key to this formula. I'm sure you've been on talk shows on TV.
Mm-hmm.
I am a veteran. And as much as I loved it and frankly made my career in the 80s, it's gotten to the point now where I felt it needed some... And I love using words like this, and I'm on NPR, I feel completely comfortable saying a diminution. It needed to be reduced. It needed to be deconstructed. And that's a big thing the show does, is it removes a lot of the things that I think restrict interesting conversation.
The program looks like it's very simple. I assume it's not as simple as it looks.
It's simple to shoot, and we do spend a lot of time reducing what is sometimes a 2 or 3 hour experience down to what I feel is the juiciest 14 minutes of that. And I think editing is one of the great luxuries. I think it's one of the things that life really needs. You know, if you bump into somebody at a cocktail party and you chat with them for 15 minutes, you can't say, you know, there was only 5 good minutes out of that.
Yeah.
I wish I could get the other 10 back. But on this show, we removed the 10 that didn't have much going on.
We saw the first episode of the new season where Sarah Silverman is riding with you in a vintage Jaguar, which is a really beautiful car.
Yeah, it is. That was a nice one.
You compared her to the car.
Yeah, don't you think? And especially the way she was dressed that day in those long bell bottoms, those blue bell bottoms. She looked exactly like the car.
Do you try to match the car to the guest?
Yeah. Like Sarah to me is kind of feline, very smooth and seductive in her maneuvers. So, and the Jaguar reminded me of her.
You know, when you do stand-up comedy, you react with the audience, and the audience, you know, comes back at you. But it's very different to be in this small metal space, elbow to elbow, knee to knee. I mean, you were just, you can't get away from each other there. That, I would think that would give it a certain intensity.
It does. It does. And, you know, she starts telling me about that she had an issue with depression as a teenager. This is not something that you're chatting about in front of 400 people on The Tonight Show. Because number one reason is, unless you have a joke, you're not even going into it.
Right.
So we get to do that. And, you know, it really led to something funny because I interrupted her to get half and half instead of milk. because I prefer half and half.
I went through a terrible depression. I remember my stepfather saying, what does it feel like?
Excuse me, may I have a half and half? Thank you. I'm so sorry.
Of all the stories, I went through a terrible depression as a kid. Excuse me, can I have some half and half? Was it that much of an emergency?
In the comedian's view of life, those things are kind of equal. Any normal person would have been so hurt and so offended. I'm telling you one of the most painful moments of my life, and you're turning to find the waiter. But because she's a comedian, she sees how funny that is, in addition to how hurtful it was. And so at the same time, she's telling me, really? She registers both things. That is something only a comedian would do.
Do you think we get a view of whatever the definition of as what they're really like might possibly be?
Absolutely. I mean, look, I know these people, and this is it. This is what they're really like. I mean, you walk out on a talk show, you know, I'm on here for 8 minutes. I want to make sure I tell a funny story or do an interesting anecdote. You're not just going to be sitting there tapping a coffee stirrer on the table and, you know, but you can do that on this show, so nobody feels that pressure to perform. And I do feel like I'm capturing their true demeanor and energy.
Now, I have to say, though, that the thing that I thought was enormously appealing about this program is how much you appear to love doing it. And after all of those sort of years of kind of deadpan comedy that we're used to from you, there you are, you're just laughing your head off at things that people say to you.
I adore these people, all of them. They have been my life. It's like when I talk to people about being a comedian, well, there's being a comedian, which is you go on stage, you perform, and it's a profession. But then there's this other life, which is you spend all your time around these people. And that has given me this technicolor existence. The show is very personal, because if I like them, we'll have fun together, and if we have fun together, you'll have fun watching.
Jerry Seinfeld, thank you.
Thank you, Linda. It's a pleasure.
Jerry Seinfeld's web series is called Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee. The second season goes online today. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Renee Montaigne.
The biggest players in video gaming are gathered here in Los Angeles this week for E3, the industry's annual trade show. Gamers have been anticipating the unveiling of new products from Microsoft, Sony, Nintendo, and other companies. NPR's Laura Seidel has spent the past few days with zombies, assassins, and one little plumber. Good morning.
Good morning.
We're going to have to find out about that plumber in a couple of minutes, because really the biggest story coming out of E3 is about the consoles, that physical box through which many games are played.
War is our business.
And the war is between Microsoft and Sony. Laura, tell us.
Yeah, well, you know, the whole thing kicked off with Microsoft's press conference, and they announced a price of $499 for their new Xbox One. That is a high price. So I think the way they're justifying it is that if it works as advertised, it's kind of an amazing technological device. So it includes the Kinect, which is their gesture-based system. So you can literally just use your hands, and it's been extremely popular. It's gotten even better. It also has voice recognition. It has Skype, so you can Skype with grandma on the TV set in the living room. It will allow you to connect directly to live TV. And so I think that's why they're justifying this $499 price.
Well, I gather on the floor of the convention center, Microsoft has a booth right next to Sony. little sparks could be flying there. And Sony also gave a press conference earlier this week, just after Microsoft dropped that $499 bomb. What did Sony have to say for itself?
Well, the biggest thing they said is ours is $100 cheaper. There are some people who speculated that they actually waited for Microsoft to say that before they announced their price. And that was very warmly received. Also, the fact that on Sony, you can absolutely use games. Now, this is a huge market among gamers, and Microsoft has been really cagey about it. So when Sony made this announcement that you could use games, there was a standing ovation. I mean, people were elated, which I know that sounds crazy, but when I actually talked to Microsoft about this, they were really evasive to that question. They kept referring people back to their website. I played both consoles, and I enjoyed the Sony one a little more, I have to say. But we're still waiting. You know, this is going to be a slow unveil through November when they finally hit the shelves.
And there is a third major console, and that's Nintendo. How is it faring in these console wars?
It's a little sad because the original Wii was actually a breakthrough. It allowed you to use sort of gesture technology where you had the controller and you could bowl with it and do all these things, and it was a huge hit. But the new one, the Wii U, which came out before last Christmas, has really not been selling so well. However, you know, Nintendo has some games that people really love, like Mario the Plumber and Donkey Kong, and that may keep people coming back.
Well, with all that technology under one roof, what's, say, one of the cooler things that you've seen this week?
I would say Disney has got something called Infinity, which takes a large number of their films, and there are games for all of the different films. And then the cool part is it's got this toy box where you can bring characters from different films and let them play together, which of course is what children actually do. And it has a real world component, so you can go and you can buy the actual physical characters. And when you buy them, you connect them to the game and they appear on your screen. And I think, you know, that seems like very smart for them to do this because it is more like children play. They don't just go into one world and stay there.
E3 is wrapping up today. Thanks very much, Laura.
You're welcome.
Laura Seidel is NPR's digital culture correspondent.